Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode has been brought to you by Worldwide Soba, a Japanese noodle production company. I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Black culture through the complicated lens of agriculture. We speak to Carla Hall about her uncompromising soul food recipes.
And I was like, what am I doing? Why am I changing my family's history for another culture?
We also hear from Gabriela Rodriguez at Harlem Grown's Youth Farm Uptown.
About empowerment and, you know, community resilience building through this work. Food is kind of just a vehicle.
Leah Penniman addresses feeling like an outsider in the farming community.
I could count on my two hands the number of people who appeared to be POC, people of color. Mm-hmm. And so I literally would go around little slips of paper and say, hey, meet at 1 o'clock under this tree so we can talk.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I love it when you guys like raise that music up to announce the fact that I'm about to start jabbering away here. This is your host, Katie Kiefer. The program is called What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. And today we're following up with Rick Dove, who is has been part of the Waterkeeper movement since 1993. He was one of the founding members of the Waterkeeper Alliance and served on its first board of directors as the former riverkeeper for the, am I saying this right, Rick? Noosey? Is that how it's?
Noose River.
Noose River, and one of the first river keepers in the Southeast. Rick assisted in the birth of many of the waterkeeper programs in North Carolina, as well as many others across the country. He holds the honorary title of Waterkeeper Alliance Board Member Emeritus and Noose River Keeper Emeritus, and his work continues to go. Actually, Rick, you pioneered the use of drones in order to more closely observe the impacts on water quality from the agriculture and coal ash plants in your area. Isn't that right? Weren't you?
Well, we
first
do it from the air, but not with drones. We do it with airplanes.
In North Carolina,
it's illegal to fly a drone over a hog farm. But that really doesn't bother us because our work with aircraft and good camera equipment is every bit as good or even better than what a drone could do.
Oh, I would think so. I was going to ask you about the ag gag laws in North Carolina because I know that ag gag laws were, North Carolina was one of the first states to adopt ag gag. Isn't that right?
I don't know. It was not the first, but it was the first to adopt ag gag with civil penalties as opposed to criminal penalties. I mean, it's thousands of dollars for taking a picture of a hog farm without permission. You could still do it from public roads and from aircraft. But if you go and trespass on their land, the consequences are pretty severe.
Wow, that is outrageous. Well, we're here to follow up on the show that we did back in September with Charles Bethay from the New Yorker magazine, talking about the aftermath of the Hurricane Florence and the record level of flooding that ensued from the hurricane itself. And at the time, I was proposing that basically the whole area that you are part of, the Cape Fear and Neuse River river basins, were basically going to become a big Superfund site. What's happened? Is it a Superfund site?
Well, it should be.
I think so.
But, you know, North Carolina and its government are the perfect example for doing the same things over and over again and expecting a different result.
Oh, dear.
It's crazy what's happening in North Carolina. I wish I could say that things are getting better.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been fighting this fight for 26 years. Yeah. We've been flying the planes and taking them in 500,000-600,000 photographs, sharing them with the state and federal government, but it's not gotten better. It's gotten worse. And as our conversation goes on, I'll explain how. But no, we haven't made any progress. We've stepped backwards. You know, here's the way it happens.
Okay.
a storm approaches and everybody gets concerned and the governor goes on TV and everybody's getting prepared. Well, certain things you can't do. You can't move millions of animals. They're going to have to stay where they are. But everybody gets real concerned. And then the storm hits and then there's this tragedy afterwards where millions of animals die and people's homes get flooded because they're in the floodplain and the animals are in the floodplain. And right after the hurricane, everybody says, well, this time we're going to do something. We're going to change all this. We're going to get them out of the floodplain, you know. And then 2 or 3 months later, it's off the radar.
Yeah.
It's not on the horizon. Nobody's talking about it. And all they do is patch up all the holes and put the animals back in and pollute the environment with the dead ones. I'll explain that as we go along.
Yes.
But nothing changes. And I'm sad to tell you that after hurricanes Dennis, Floyd, Irene, Matthew, Florence, everything is just the same, except it's getting worse.
Oh, Rick, that is so discouraging. I hate to hear that. I really do. And I can hear how discouraged you are, because I know that after Hurricane Matthew, you wrote an article, which I accessed online today. I think it was basically for your Waterkeeper Alliance, you know, sort of personnel. But basically, it was a very common sense solution, or one common sense solution, which was to move the animals out of the floodplain. And clearly, that didn't happen before Florence, and obviously, it's not clearly happening now. What does the industry say? I mean, let's back up for a second. First of all, how many of those lagoons eventually breached? North Carolina, for people who don't know, is like the second biggest hog producer in the country.
Well, that's an interesting question. If you were to ask the industry, they would say, "Oh, about 13 lagoons got flooded, and 2 or 3 breached."
Right.
But North Carolina Policy Watch, which is a very good internet site, and people for that site go out and really do some good research. They went and they based their findings on what the farmers themselves reported. And what we know is it was, according to them, 46 lagoons were flooded, discharged wastewater into the adjacent land streams, or sustained structural damage as a result of Hurricane Florence.
Wow.
That is way beyond anything the industry itself reported.
Or even your DEQ, because as I recall, before I interviewed you and Charles Bethea back in September after the storm, the DEQ reported to me that only 4 or 5 lagoons had actually breached and that the flooding wasn't
that much.
And
from my own flight, I know that number is way, way low.
Right.
I think that what the farmers themselves reported is probably the best information.
Indeed, I would think so. I mean, who knows better than they do? So let's talk a little bit about what the chemical findings were, because it wasn't just the hog and poultry industries that were seriously affected by Hurricane Florence. It was also those big coal ash dumps. So you had both the hog and poultry industries were flooding either the waste lagoons or the big piles of poultry litter, which we'll talk about in a minute. And or you had the coal ash dumps that were also either breached or flooded. So what in the end, were you able to access water quality samples and soil quality samples to see what level of pollution actually ensued from Hurricane Florence?
Well, we know that a tremendous amount of hog waste went down the river, and there were some samples taken. I don't have the results in front of me on waste from hog lagoons, but let me just say that many of the rivers in North Carolina turned the pink color of hog lagoons as this stuff moved downstream.
Okay.
So the waters were heavily contaminated. The state said to stay away from them altogether. There were warnings posted by the state. So there's no question that the waters were heavily polluted as a result of all the waste that came down. But this time we not only had the hog waste and the poultry waste, and we really do need to spend more time talking about poultry if we have time today. But
yes, I would love to.
In addition to that was the coal ash ponds that had flooded. And we've been having problems with coal ash ponds and coal ash waste, which is highly toxic.
Yeah.
It's a cancer-causing agent. It's got all sorts of bad stuff in it, arsenic, barium.
A lot of heavy metals,
Oh, heavy metals. It's incredible what's in coal ash.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the Dan River spill. That wasn't a result of a hurricane. It just happened. And then we caught Duke Energy illegally discharging, without a permit, millions of gallons of coal ash wastewater into the Cape Fear River, up the upper Cape Fear River, near Clymers. And then we had Sutton, which has always been a problem. And then with the hurricanes, the Lee plant up on the Neuse River discharged coal ash in tremendous amounts, along with a horrific discharge out of the Sutton plant in Wilmington. There were samples taken by Waterkeeper and other organizations, and they were taken right at the discharge point, and their levels were far in excess of the norm for arsenic and other dangerous chemicals.
Right.
But the state went in and sampled further downriver where the water was more diluted, and they came up with samples that said everything was okay.
Uh-huh.
What the public really needs to know is this stuff settles out into the sediments.
Right.
And it isn't, and it's collected in the sediments. And over time, as the water moves downstream, it continues to pick up those chemicals and move them on down.
Uh-huh.
So the sampling, there's a conflict between the state and the environmental community. It all depends on where the samples were taken, whether they were taken out of the sediments or whether they were taken in the water column, how long after the discharge, how close to the discharge site. But clearly, you can't discharge as much coal ash as we filmed and videotaped coming out of those facilities without doing an awful lot of harm to drinking water and
Absolutely.
The river itself.
Absolutely. And then we forgot to mention the other thing that happened, and this was also more in the Cape Fear, I think, than the Neuse, but the regulations or the something that the Star News, the local Star News, local paper Star News reported this, and I'll just read this quote from Raleigh, that Chemours, which is a big chemical company that makes Teflon, I believe, and is associated with the DuPont company, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, Chemours, which has a big presence in North Carolina, would have to analyze Gen-X, which is a chemical used in baking Teflon, and other chemicals in the Cape Fear River sediment and measure the chemical levels at raw water intakes according to a revised consent order between the chemical giant, the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, and the Cape Fear River Watch. Talk about that. I mean, that's like that. There's your triple whammy. So first you have all of the animal waste. Then you have the coal ash dumping, and then you have the illegal dumping from these chemical companies. So, I mean, at this point, the fact that North Carolina isn't just exploding with cancer and other related diseases is kind of mind-boggling. Like what?
Well, yeah, you know, North Carolina.
What are you seeing in public health?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, what kind of impacts on public health are you seeing, if any, from all of this pollution?
Well, there are serious impacts to public health from the hog waste getting in the waters and in the air. We know that. There are a number of studies that have been done on that. So that's a given.
Yep.
And that includes poultry waste as well.
Yep.
We know that there are serious health consequences associated with the coal ash. That is also a given. With this, petrofluoride ethers that are being discharged from the Chemours plant, there's a little bit of a question as to just how much health consequences are associated with that. There are two people that I would recommend you get on your show. One of them is Dr. Larry Cahoon, C-A-H-O-O-N, and Kemp Burdett. Dr. Cahoon is associated with UNC Wilmington, and he's done a lot of the testings for this chemical.
Uh-huh.
And he found it in his drinking water a couple of weeks before it was even announced by the state.
Wow.
And he can address some of the health consequences with
okay.
it. But then Kemp Burdett is also the Cape Fear Riverkeeper, and he works with Dr. Cahoon, and it was the Cape Fear Riverkeeper program that entered into the consent decree.
Right.
So there's an awful lot of information that would take up a whole segment of your show just talking about that particular discharge from that plant.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll move on then in that case, because I know that your primary focus has been around the poultry and hog industries. And so I wanted to ask you about the photographs that you sent me, which showed these, you know, enormous, I mean, I can't even calculate how many tons. That was just one. Was that one farm that you sent me pictures of or
no,
multiple?
No, you have two separate farms, but I have 27 of them.
Wow.
That are on our radar right now that I'm following and reporting to the state. But I just sent you pictures of two,
right?
Both in the Neuse River watershed.
The ground looks very swampy there.
There's
a lot of standing water in between these enormous, and I'm telling you folks, enormous piles, like hundreds of yards long, it looks like. How many tons of waste do you think that represents, Rick?
Well, I don't know how many chickens there are in those two facilities. We have asked that question.
Right.
But in North Carolina, that information is proprietary, and the state rarely ever shares any of that information with us. But looking at those piles of waste, which are 2.5 football fields long, and I encourage people, if you put them up on
your
website,
I'll put them on my radio page, absolutely, and I'll put them on my Facebook page.
But the Trent River runs right behind that first site, where you see it's the bigger of the two sites,
right,
where you see it's 2.5 football fields with row after row, of chicken waste containing what we believe are the bodies of dead, decaying chickens, along with some litter and sawdust and other materials that are composting. But the Trent River is just a matter of feet away. And in some of the pictures that we have, the floodwaters from the Trent River, and not from the hurricane, but just from these rains we've been having recently, because all those pictures are very recent.
Right.
The floodwaters are coming right up to the piles, very close.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then on the other one, the second site, the Tuckahoe Creek runs right adjacent to that field, and we actually have photographs of the water running from the waste piles into a ditch that goes right to Tuckahoe Creek, which also enters into the Trent River.
Wow.
But here's the real problem with these waste piles.
Yeah.
The industry first said, when after the hurricane, we were going to compost these dead chickens inside the confinement buildings. I'm not seeing that.
Right.
I'm seeing them composted out in the environment, exposed to the elements. There's also a regulation in North Carolina that says you can't leave piles of chicken litter uncovered for more than 15 days. They're supposed to put a cover over them to keep the rain from going in them and washing into the groundwater, into the local adjacent waters. Well, as you see these photos, they're not covered.
No.
And they haven't been covered since they've been first put there, likely right after Hurricane Florence.
Wow.
The other thing is, taxpayers pay for manure storage sheds to be built on many of these chicken facilities.
No way.
But
I did not know that.
Yes, they do. But what you find under these manure sheds are the tractors and instead of the waste. And on that one picture or group of pictures that I sent on that first facility, you'll actually see two huge storage sheds without any waste that I can see stored in there, but tractors are in there instead to keep them out of the weather.
Oh, my God.
So instead of covering them as they should, instead of composting them inside the confinement buildings as they said they would, or at least putting as much as they could in the storage shed, that was all too hard. They simply put it out in nature, under the elements, and we can't even get to it under the law to sample because we'd be trespassing.
Right,
so we turned it into the state, and we turned it into the state water quality people. But they, in turn, said, no, this isn't our problem, and they gave it to the Department of Agriculture to go look at. Well, you know the Department of Agriculture in North Carolina is never going to find anything wrong on any farm. They just aren't going to do it. So I have very little hope that all this work we're doing to expose this chicken litter waste running in our rivers and streams is going to come to zero.
I hope that's not true, Rick. Let me ask you this. What about the local population? Are they not concerned about the fact that the governor is issuing, you know, drinking water, you know, don't drink the water, don't take showers, or any of the other measures that presumably are being taken to protect people from this water pollution issue? I mean, is there no pushback from your local populations?
They're screaming bloody murder.
Uh-huh.
But the problem we have is that the legislature in North Carolina is owned and operated by the polluters.
Yeah.
They give money to these people in such amounts that they own them, and they get anything they want in terms of legislation. We have a good governor, but if the governor has vetoed some of these horrific, terrible bills that they've sent through, and they just override his veto.
Oh,
last week, I went to a hearing in Kenansville. It was a public hearing because the permits for both poultry and swine are being renewed after every 5 years they get renewed. And we're speaking about what ought to be in there to help control this pollution.
Yeah.
Normally, it is so overloaded with hog producers and poultry producers that there are only a few, 2, 3, 10 environmentalists in there giving their side of the view.
Right.
But in this last hearing, there were 13 producers, hog producers and poultry producers that spoke, and almost 30 environmentalists, and the audience was made up of people from not just environmentalists, but people who lived in the community that were screaming that they wanted relief. They can't live under these conditions.
Right, right.
But I'm telling you, nothing will ever come out of our General Assembly in North Carolina to protect the people, only the industry, because the industry owns our legislators.
That is a shocking, you know, I mean, not surprising, but shocking. And on that note, we're going to take a short break for a sponsor drop. And we will be right back with Rick Dove from the Waterkeeper Alliance. We're talking about North Carolina in the wake of Hurricane Florence. So stay tuned for more.
This episode has been brought to you by Worldwide Soba, a Japanese noodle production company. Founded by Shuichi Kotani, Worldwide Soba offers noodle consulting services in addition to supplying a variety of tools for wannabe noodle makers. Want to take a class? Worldwide Soba has it. Need a traditional Japanese soba knife? Worldwide Soba has that too. To learn more, visit worldwide-soba.com.
Thank you. I do loves me some soba. Thank you very much to our new sponsor, Worldwide Soba. That's great. So we're talking to Rick Dove. He is the senior advisor to the Waterkeeper Alliance in the Neuse River area of North Carolina. We're talking about the aftermath of Hurricane Florence and the fact that the state legislature appears to be owned by industry. This is not an uncommon thing in the United States. strangely, it's amazing, but that's what's happened. But I, to go back to that question just for a second, and then I want to move on a little bit, but what about sort of new, like when we had the big new wave of you know, congressional elections that brought in a Democratic House of Representatives, what happened in North Carolina, Rick? Did you not see any relief in that, in your state elections?
A little bit. The Republican Party, and let me first say that even when the Democrats controlled the legislature in North Carolina, we had these same problems. but they weren't overriding the governor's vetoes. Since this Republican legislature has come into being, was about 6-8 years ago, they've been passing laws that are just terrible and then overriding the governor's veto. This last election took their veto-proof or their veto power away from them. I mean, they could still veto. I mean, the governor can veto, but the legislature doesn't have the votes to override the vetoes anymore. So that's a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
But we, you know, that doesn't change all the bad stuff that's happened in the last 3 or 4 years.
No, it doesn't.
Regarding legislation.
And it comes back to this idea of what you proposed right after Hurricane Matthew, which was, what, 3 years ago? Moving, you know, a lot of these hog and poultry operations to higher ground. So what would that mean, though, to the people who are actually, you know, the contract farmers who are working within that industry? I mean, that wouldn't be so great for them.
No. You know, and I'm glad you asked that question because I want to correct something I said earlier. You know, after Hurricane Floyd and Dennis, the state put a lot of money into buying out facilities in the floodplain, and some actually got bought out, but not all. They didn't want to get bought out. It was a volunteer program. But there's been no money since 2007 to do any more buyouts. But now North Carolina's come up with another $5 million, which is a drop in the bucket for what they have to pay to get these facilities shut down or moved. But there is now a little money coming in to help with that, and I wanted to correct what I said earlier.
Right.
But the other thing is that the growers in North Carolina are almost victims. They are victims like everybody else.
I consider them victims, absolutely.
They were told to put in this lagoon and spray field. They were told it was okay to put it in the floodplain, and they followed the regulations of the state, at least to the extent that they developed their facility. Now they've invested, they had to pay for all that. The industry didn't pay for that. They had to. Now we have new technologies to replace lagoons and spray fields, but the industry refuses to pay for it. And the growers themselves, the producers, who own the land and the buildings and the debt that goes with raising these animals, they can't afford to make the switch.
Of course not.
So we're stuck with a Chinese corporation who owns almost all the hogs in North Carolina, including Smithfield Foods. They own the whole Smithfield Foods.
Yes.
That, you know, they're not going to spend the money to make the transition. So everybody in North Carolina is on the hit, both the people who live here, the rivers and streams, and the producers themselves.
Yes. That's right, because they're drinking that water too. And I know for a fact that they're, you know, they're somebody who goes into farming, you know, growing hogs or chickens for a big corporation isn't doing it so that they can pollute the rivers and streams. I understand that, and I hope everybody else does, because I think there's a lot of finger pointing at the people who are involved with this industry who don't recognize that the enormous costs required to take care of animal waste simply is not shouldered by the industry that is making billions of dollars off of these people. I mean, they are making bank, and these guys are stuck with, you know, lower and lower prices thanks to consolidation, and they're expected to manage these literally the equivalent of a small city's worth of you know, animal waste with no treatment. There's no waste treatment program, right?
That's correct. And you know, what's happened is the industry has used this outhouse system, which is nothing but a hole in the ground, dirt, a hole in the ground filled full of this feces and urine. And when it fills up from the hogs defecating in the barns and flushing it out, then they dump it on the fields.
Right.
Well, if you have people, you can have a system similar to that on a smaller scale if you spread it out all over the country, like it used to be with traditional farmers where they could use small lots of this stuff as fertilizer.
Sure.
But when you move either people or animals like pigs into a city environment, you can't bring the outhouse with you.
Right.
You've got to put in an expensive wastewater treatment plant.
Yes.
And that's what the industry refuses to do.
Right.
It's common sense. It's not a matter of science. It's just pure common sense.
It is pure common sense, and it would go a long way towards mitigating greenhouse gases because, of course, the VOCs that come off of those lagoons and off those piles of poultry litter are part of, you know, the problem with animal agriculture. And, you know, if they were able to regulate that, and if those greenhouse gases were captured or baffled or purified or any of the air scrubbers, or, you know, there's all kinds of methods to deal with this stuff, and they just don't do it. So it's really down to forcing corporations to take the responsibility for this type of agriculture if they want to continue it. And I don't see that happening.
Well, you know, I'll make this quick, but animal agriculture as we know it today, including the industrial production, may be a thing of the past in the next 20 years. They're already able to grow meat in the lab by just giving nutrients to cells and reproducing the cells in the lab. If that turns out to be safe, tasty, and inexpensive, and it hits the marketplace, it will put the animal industry out of business, because there's no reason to go through all the expense to grow the plants and then take the plants and go through all the expense to feed the animals with the plants to have meat if you can grow it in a lab. So, you know, this is either going to get solved by Mother Nature giving us a consequence that we have to deal with, which requires that these facilities shut down. That could happen. Or that the marketplace itself is going to turn around and find a solution where we don't have to raise animals anymore. So I do believe a solution is coming. I just hope it happens in my lifetime, but at my age, it probably won't.
Don't say that, Rick. You're going to live forever. You have to, because you have to keep doing this work. Nobody else is doing it.
Well, I do so much enjoy talking on your show and talking and having your audience here.
Thank you.
Please feel free to give them my email address, rdove2017@gmail.com. And I'd be happy to answer any questions they have, including from producers across, you know, in your listening audience that think that some of the things I'm saying are wrong. I'd be happy to
I think it's important to engage people who are actually doing this work rather than just speaking to, you know, our little bubble of environmental activists or whatever, or, you know, non-meat-eating people. I'm a meat eater. I like the industry. I want it to clean up. I want it to reduce its scale. I want it to be, because I think there are some benefits. And otherwise, what are we going to do? We're going to stop growing cows and pigs and chickens? Like, we're not going to have them anymore? Because if you don't eat them, then nobody's going to grow them, and then they go extinct. So is that what we want? You know, it's not so easy to decide which way this should go. But I do think that there is some kind of a middle ground where animals, you know, just as they used to be on a farm, can be part of a mixed-use model where they actually add nutrients to the soil, become a carbon sink, and so forth. And I think that that's where we want to go, at least in the foreseeable future. You know, 50 years from now or 100 years from now, you're right. Maybe we won't even have the cropland to feed these things. Never mind our own selves. But I do think that there is a middle ground. I think the industry has to take responsibility for the pollution that it creates and has to start paying for it. And I think that's only going to happen through legislation, and that's only going to happen if we get rid of Citizens United. Am I right, Rick?
Oh, you're absolutely right about Citizens United. You sure are. I mean, our politics in this country right now, best word I can think of to describe it is bizarre.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I just came back from Spain, where I spent a month trying to save money on my fuel bills because it cost me so much to heat my house in Rhode Island. So I was living in Spain. I rented an apartment, and I connected with some activists who are pushing back against the growth of industrial hog farming and dairying, but especially hog farming in Spain. Because, you know, in Spain, you know, the national religion is pig. I mean, everyone eats pork. You have to be a Hamanarian to live in Spain. There's no question about it. And everything, you know, they eat pig every day, and every person eats at least one pig a year, at least that much, you know, in terms of pounds. So, but they are seeing this enormous uptick in industrial scale farming, largely at the behest of the Chinese, who right now, as you probably know, are enduring a huge epidemic of some kind of, you know, swine fever, swine flu that's killing their herds of pigs, and also because they have such a tremendous demand for meat now, and that's why they bought Smithfield. And so they're coming into Spain, and they are contracting with the Spanish to build these big farms and basically engage in exactly the same disastrous model that we have here. So it was really interesting to talk to these groups, these NGOs like Compassion in World Farming and with Food and Water Watch Europe, to talk about the methods and the strategies that they have for discouraging the growth of this type of agriculture. And so that after that long-winded discussion on my part, is there such a thing happening in North Carolina? Do you see populations, you know, when they come into the state and they say, oh, we're going to build another hog farm, are there groups of people who are pushing back? Are there editorials in the newspapers about it? You know, stuff like that.
Well, we have a ban in North Carolina. You can't build a new hog farm in
North Carolina
without putting in the new technology. So we've got a solution there. It's not going to get any worse. But with the poultry industry, that's not true. They're totally, almost totally unregulated in North Carolina, and they can develop anywhere but just getting a building permit. They don't need anything else. Just go build the barns and get the chickens, and you're done.
Oh, my Lord.
And the regulations are so few with regard to poultry that it's ridiculous. But North Carolina is a good example for others to look at for reasons why you do not want to do this. So here's what I would recommend to anybody in any state or the population of any state or foreign country. If you're thinking about doing that, you come to North Carolina. You get in an airplane with me, and let me fly you across eastern North Carolina. Right. And then you talk to the people here. And if you pay attention, you'll go back home and you'll say, we're not going to do that here.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the governor of South Carolina, when this industry exploded in North Carolina, they tried to go to South Carolina, and the governor made an official statement. He said, we've seen the mess you've made of North Carolina. You're not coming here.
Wow.
So if you want to see what you don't want, you come to North Carolina, and we'll show you.
Yeah, really. Well, Rick, I'm going to wrap it up here. Thank you so much. Now is your moment to shamelessly promote yourself. So first of all, tell people about the Waterkeeper Alliance website. How can people stay on top of what's going on at the Neuse River and the Cape Fear? We're going to do and send me that information about your colleague on the Cape Fear Riverkeeper.
I sure will.
Do you write a blog? I mean, how do people, give your email address again, you know, all of that stuff.
My email address is rdove2017@gmail.com. They can also go on the waterkeeper.org website. That's waterkeeper.org. And there's a whole section in there on, well, first of all, there's a section on river keepers across the world because we're worldwide.
Yeah.
And there's also information on river keepers in your area and what rivers they're on. Mm-hmm. And they can access every one of those programs and see what they're about. And then there's a special section on all the CAFO problems here in North Carolina. And so that we have a tremendous campaign here. So I encourage everybody to go to that waterkeeper.org website and go to the CAFO section in there and in North Carolina, and you'll be amazed at the information you'll find.
Well, I'm gonna do that right now. No, I'm actually gonna do a bunch of programs around pushing back. I was so inspired by these people in Spain who are working so hard to, you know, definitely take that lesson of North Carolina to heart, that I thought I would try to sort of drum up a bunch of other people around the country, in hog farm country, especially like Missouri and Iowa, to see, you know, how communities are responding to the expansion of the industries into their communities. So, you know, stay tuned for that, folks. That's coming up this in the next few weeks. I'm going to be queuing up a bunch of people to talk about that, and I'll get that Cape Fear River Keeper on as well. Rick, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. You're going to come back, I hope, and
yeah,
we'll find more
you.
To
it's
talk
always
about.
A pleasure. I'll be happy to come back.
Likewise,
anytime.
Really appreciate your time. And thanks to my sponsor. It's great to have somebody new on board here at Heritage Radio Network. And remember, folks, this is our 10th year. I've been doing this show for 10 years now. Not this particular show, but pretty close. I started out with Patrick Martins, our founder, in March of 20. March of 2009, I guess. And here I am 10 years older. I'm still sitting in the same chair. So thanks a lot for listening. Thanks for all your support. And remember to hit the donate button whenever the spirit moves you. Thanks for listening. See you next week, folks. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.